low. It's showtime at the Apollo minus the Kiki Shepherd. With about a when the leopard prints. Teddy, Pendergrass, cooler than Freddie Jackson, sipping a milkshake in a snowstorm. Left my throat warm in the dorm room at the AU. We blew hay to athletes, might cake you, but you must have been mistaken with them statements that you make, huh?
Previously broadcast program.
Welcome everyone. You are listening to Digital Sites on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. I am your host, Sausan Kadura. Digital Sites airs every first Thursday of every month, as you know by now, from 2 to 3 p.m. We cover topics and news related to visual digital arts in all its forms, whether it's printed or projected on screens or even projected on buildings and walls. One of the digital sites you see all around you on a daily basis is words. We are exposed to dozens, if not hundreds, of typefaces every day by the simple act of reading the word around us. Phones, computers, tablets, TVs, books, documents, street signs, posters, menus, and the list goes on of examples of platforms that show us text every day. So most people don't realize the importance of typeface designers. Their work makes sure a language adapt to all its modern usage. One typeface doesn't fit all platforms, all needs, or even the stories that the written word aims to tell. So today, during the first part of the show, we will be focusing on typefaces and their relationship with culture and identity. Recently, graphic designer Trey Seals discovered that only 3 to 3.5% of all practicing designers in the United States are black. That numbers goes down even more dramatically when we talk about typeface designers in particular. So Trey decided to infuse more of his identity and his culture into the design world, and he chose to do that through one of the most basic fundamental elements used in design, an element that exists in everything, as I mentioned, typography. So he founded the typeface foundry Vocal Type, and he started designing himself several typefaces. So what's interesting is that not only these typefaces are being designed by a black designer, but the typefaces themselves were designed to reflect important historical and social events that concerns various marginalized groups in the US. So for example, He designed a typeface called Martin, inspired by Martin Luther King, but also he inspired, designed a typeface called Ruben, inspired by the National Chicano Moratorium Movement, which protested the Vietnam War, and was led by journalist Ruben Salazar. He designed Carrie, a sans-serif font or a typeface that honors women's suffrage in the United States. He designed a typeface called Stonewall, which is inspired by the LGBTQ 1969 riots of at the Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village in New York City, and so on. So you have this list of typefaces that he designed that has a piece of history linked to them, and now they're being infused in the design world. So how was Trey inspired by this movement to create these typefaces? This is what we will learn more about during the first part of the show. I will play an interview I did with Trey Seals about his work, about his types, the reason he started his type foundry, and how he approaches typeface design and design in general. Keep listening to Digital Sites. Joining me on the phone from Washington, D.C., Trey Seals. Trey is a brand specialist. He is a graphic designer. He is also a type designer. And he is the founder of Vocal Type, which is an independent type foundry. So type design and typefaces are rarely talked about outside design circles, despite the fact that typefaces are everywhere. Everyone consumes them and everyone is influenced by their design on a daily basis. Typefaces are an essential element of the visual digital world that surrounds us, whether it's printed or online. But like many things that surround us in society, typefaces also hide behind them a problematic reality that is not often talked about in design circles. So what do I mean by that? And what is typeface or type design to begin with? Well, we will answer all these questions and much more with my guest, Trey Seals. So first of all, Trey, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thank you for having me. I greatly appreciate it.
So I guess before we talk about what I just briefly mentioned, maybe for our listeners who are not designers, can you maybe explain a little bit what is typeface, what is type design, and what does a typeface designer like yourself do exactly?
A typeface is basically the design of letter forms. So like, for example, let's say every book you've ever read, every advertisement you've ever seen, every logo you've ever seen, somebody spent time designing those letters so that another designer can use those letters to make that logo or that advertisement or that book. And a typeface designer is the person who actually designs these letter forms.
So what people usually refer to as fonts when they talk about, you know, Times New Roman or Bodoni or Arial, Helvetica, and in reality, these are typefaces, not fonts.
Exactly.
On your website, you explain that at some point in your career as a designer, you discovered a sort of worrying reality about the design world in general and the typeface design industry in particular. And that reality, one, it made you maybe more determined to stay a designer, but also it was what led to eventually create Vocal Type, which I mentioned at the beginning. So before we talk about Vocal Type in particular, can you maybe talk to us about this reality? Who predominantly designed all these typefaces that we widely use and consume?
The majority of all type designers are white male, and there are a few women type designers, but I am the third black font designer in America. Because of all this, we hear a lot about diversity, and in the broader design perspective, only 3% of all designers in the world in America are black. And I want to figure out a way to inject a piece of my heritage and the heritage of other minority cultures into design itself at the root of basically all forms of graphic design, which is typography.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a little bit, but we have this image of the industry, the design industry, the creative industry, to be liberal, to be diverse, to be progressive. But the reality, as you mentioned, is really on the opposite of that. The statistics shows a completely different reality. Why do you think there's this lack of diversity, like you mentioned?
I think on one hand, there's this lack of understanding of what design is in a global perspective, but also just from an educational perspective, it's not something you hear about. It's never really presented as a career choice to younger audiences. And you really just don't hear about it. It's something that exists, but it never enters the minds of the average human.
And I read how I learned about vocal type, because I read an article that was featured in an interview with you as well. And in the article, they were talking about how when it comes to typeface design, the two main pathways are the tech industry and design industry. And both these industries seem to be predominantly white males. So does that influence a lot the lack of diversity in typeface design industry in particular?
Definitely. For me, it's kind of it's more empowering to me, like this idea of promoting the history of minority cultures through type design. It really just makes me want to do what I do more. And when I see more and more people reaching out, telling me how inspiring what I'm doing is for them, because they never felt they had a voice, and it just makes everything more worth it.
Another thing I was wondering about typefaces, in what settings usually they're created? Because we know Google, for example, Google Fonts, and we know Adobe Fonts, which is Adobe. Anyone from the creative community know the company Adobe. They have a major monopoly on the design world. And they have a team of typeface designers within the company. So you have a lot of typefaces created in that setting, in more corporate settings, but also you see a lot of typefaces being sold on different websites. So it made me wonder, do we have information about where the majority of typefaces are being created? Are they being created from in a corporate settings, or are we still mainly individual independent designers are creating all the typefaces?
It's somewhere in between more independent type designers and smaller design studios. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned this idea of font design being in between tech and design industries. So within a font design team, you may have a programmer. You may have someone who specializes in designing for certain languages. You may have people who simply do the kerning and letter spacing. And you have all these different people who contribute to this one team in order to create this one font within a studio. And then more than likely, most fonts come from individual type designers.
So I guess that leads us to your initiatives about typeface design. I mentioned it at the beginning, vocal type. So can you talk to us about what is vocal type, and maybe sort of talk about the story behind it? How did you get the idea, and how did this idea really started?
Definitely. I come from a graphic design background, and when I graduated from college, my main specialty became branding. And I did a lot of work for a lot of different companies, in-house, studios, and everything in between. And one day I was working on a branding project, searching for inspiration, and everything started just to look the same to me. And it got really depressing, and I started wondering if I had chosen the wrong career. And the more I looked into it, I found these demographics of the design industry in America and other countries. And essentially, design is majority white and majority male, and always has been. So when you have an industry dominated by a certain perspective, then that one singular perspective influences all these other areas of design, whether it be teaching or the actual creations being put out, and just even our way of thinking. And the more I thought about it, I wanted to figure out a way to increase or add a piece of minority culture's perspective to the design industry. And I knew I couldn't simply change demographics. And I had tried making a font before, and I really enjoyed it. So I thought, why not start a foundry when there's so much rich history within all these different underrepresented cultures, and make typefaces based on those histories?
So can you talk to us more about these histories? So you guys have 5 different fonts, and they're all based on a specific, you know, important social or historical moment. So can you talk to us more about that?
Definitely. The first font I ever made through Vocal was called Martin, and that was named after Dr. Martin Luther King and the last cause he ever got to fight for before being killed in 1968. That was called the Memphis Sanitation Strike. And during that time, protesters carried these signs that read, "I am a man and union justice now," and "Honor King and racism." And so I made this font based on the lettering style that you see on those protest signs. In other perspectives, I made a font family called Eva, which is based on a series of banners created during a women's march in Argentina, named after Eva Perón, who was the first lady of Argentina and a huge fighter for women's rights and women's suffrage.
So how do you end up choosing which you know banner to base your typeface on? And did you have enough pictures of these, you know, writings, I guess, or these banners? Did you have enough pictures or resources in the archives to be able to make an entire alphabet?
Well, when I'm choosing a typeface to base to work on or to looking for resources for a future typeface, I try to find images, let's say if it's from a protest that multiple people have a connection to. So maybe it's one sign that hundreds of people carry, or if it's like one long banner that 10 people carried. And from there, I try to find a certain leader of this certain movement that I'm trying to highlight and promote. And from there, based on the lettering style, I can take certain pieces of certain characters to make others to fill in the gaps.
One thing I read and I thought was interesting, that when you were researching, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I understood it was a sort of collective initiative in a research phase. So other people will help, you know, find different pictures as well, or different archival, you know, resources to help you eventually design this typeface. Is that correct?
Usually the people who send me images are actually just fans of Vocal Type who would like to see like a certain person or a certain movement highlighted and made a font based on. But other than that, it's just me working here.
And, you know, it's good that you mentioned that, because I don't think many of our listeners will realize how much work goes into designing a typeface. I remember I was seeing a talk by a designer called Mia Sinelli, I believe, and she designed a typeface based on a handwriting that she saw in a historical document that was hung on a small museum in a town in Michigan. I believe the town now is a ghost town. It used to be a mining town. And so she was saying she didn't have much experience about type design. And she was saying that she thought all she has to do is take a picture, outline the letters, and then that's it. And then she realized there's so much detail. So can you maybe talk about that? Like, what is all this, you know, details and technical consideration you have to take into account when you're actually designing a typeface, an entire alphabet that is usable?
There's so much. There's surprisingly a lot of math. So you have to when you see a stroke or a line within a letter, you have to make sure that all those different strokes match up and are consistent. Mm-hmm. And especially in a handwriting typeface, those are definitely by far the hardest. But usually just making one particular weight of a typeface takes 100 plus 200 hours. And
oh, wow.
You have to think about the size and how it's going to read at small sizes and large sizes. And if, let's say, it doesn't work at small sizes, will you have to make a version that does work specifically for those sizes, and just all kinds of things. There's a lot to it.
So another thing I was thinking about, because I've heard many type designers before, and one of the frustrations they have is that a lot of time they put all these hours into working into a design, but then rarely they get to see how this font or this typeface is actually used. And so I wanted to sort of ask you about that, about the usage of these typefaces. One, on this, you know, general level, how type designers, you know, rarely see how their typefaces is used. But also, in your case in particular, these typefaces have such a story behind them that it's very, it reflects a very important social and historical moment or message. So what would you, I guess my question, if you find, you know, something like, I don't know, Breitbart or something using a font, the font Martin, like how would you kind of react to it? How would you react if, you know, maybe corporation or maybe, you know, things like Breitbart or something that are very controversial on this issue would use your typefaces? Would you be amused or be annoyed or what is it?
I think I'd have mixed feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So to answer your first question, it is sometimes hard to actually see how people use your fonts, but it's getting easier, I think, with social media and sites like fontsinuse.com. And I actually have some people who are so proud of what they made that they'll send it to me so I can see what they've done with it.
Mm-hmm.
And as for how people use it, there was one particular instance that I felt was extremely perfect and on the nose. There was this play that was going on in Memphis about the Memphis sanitation strike, which is what influenced the Martin font. And all of the actors were from Memphis. All the people putting on the play were from Memphis. And some of them were actual descendants of the strike that I was highlighting.
Mm-hmm.
So they used my font for the website. You know, the designers who worked on the website were from Memphis, and then it all just came together beautifully. But there was another instance where a European magazine filled with just white men talking about fashion who used Martin. And part of me was wondering if it was appropriation or was it like, did they not read the story and they just thought it was cool, so they used it, which turned out to be the case. And I just thought it was interesting how my idea of wanting to inject this piece of diverse history into design just kind of happened within this completely different cultural context, which was really the goal. So I just thought it kind of turned out perfectly.
Another thing that, I mean, we're talking about the importance of having diversity when it comes to designers. Another thing I also read on your website is you touch upon diversifying inspiration. And you talked about at one point that you moved back, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I understood you moved back to your town in Michigan just because you were saying that if we all look at the same thing, none of us will create something different. So you were talking about the importance of also diversifying our sources of inspiration, not have all designers look at the same thing, all on Instagram and all of us on the internet. So can you talk more about that, and how do you apply, why do you think that's important, and how do you apply that in your work?
I think it goes back to this idea of this lack of diversity informing like the way we think and the way we see things in design history in general. I feel like if you live in a city like, let's say, New York, for instance, where there are thousands and thousands of designers all in New York, all seeing the same signage and creating designs that really, really look similar, it's, to me, when it comes to being inspired by the same thing, it's not about maybe the inspiration as much as what comes from it.
Mm-hmm.
For me, darn, I can't remember the name of the designer, but there was this designer who moved out into the wilderness without internet for a year just to see what they could create. And it really changed their design perspective, just having this kind of restart button. And for me, that's me on a daily basis, not being influenced by something everyone sees every day, and just having a fresh perspective is really what influences me where I work now.
I saw an example on your website as well, which I thought it was interesting, where you were creating a typeface for a magazine, and I think the theme was around sound, if I'm not mistaken. And
right.
Can you talk about that? Because also you kind of had the same process. The way you chose at the end the typeface was also inspired by an important sort of artistic, I guess, event. So can you talk about that?
Definitely. This font family I designed for Oakland-based magazine called Umber. And it's based around black and brown perspectives. And each issue covers a different theme. So for the third issue, the theme was sound. And since it's the magazine itself is inspired by black and brown perspectives, I created a typeface inspired by the first black-owned record label in America called Broom Special Phonograph Records. And I felt like just having another sans serif wouldn't be enough and wouldn't really have that great of an impact. So I turned that one typeface into an entire family where the letters no longer are just filled in and solid, but look like sound waves.
The last decade, I read several articles about how the last decade was dominated by the same geometric sans serif typefaces. And so I guess as a typeface designer, your perspective, you can't see in the future, but do you feel that maybe now coming into a new decade, you will see the industry maybe coming out of this trend, maybe including more creative designs?
I don't think like the whole geometric sans thing is going away. I just think it's going to be slightly different with the increase in use of variable fonts. Like I'm seeing more variable fonts where they may go from a sans serif and transform into a serif, or they may increase in contrast, or the entire font may change completely.
Can you explain what is variable fonts for our listeners?
Yeah, so a variable font essentially is a single font file. You don't have regular bold, italic, or anything like that, but you essentially have these gauges that you can toggle between, and it'll change the way the font looks. So it may have the italics at a specific angle, and you can change the angle however you see fit. So basically, everyone who has this font file can essentially create a font that's completely different.
Yes. So do you feel that eventually in the design world, they're gonna veer away a little bit from the geometric, or just the variable fonts would just add maybe a little bit of variety?
I think the variable fonts were mainly added a little bit of variation. But I do see a bit more people playing with serif fonts, but I'm not sure how long it's going to stay like that.
Yes, I saw an article written by Rachel Howley, and it's called Here's the Typography of the Next Decade, and she's talking about how she believes that the geometric sans serif will finally go away, and the age of font, I'm quoting here, the age of font minimalism is coming to a close, and she believes that because there's a lot of typefaces from the Didonis family coming in. So this is why I wanted to ask you about, you are a typeface designer, so I wanted to ask you if you have also the same optimistic maybe a view of the future.
Definitely. Like, I don't think... Like, I would say that the geometric sans is probably going away, but I don't think the sans serif period is going anywhere.
So
I think there's still a lot to explore there. Yeah.
In the article I mentioned before that this is where I learned about vocal type, and there was an interview with you. The article was on Eye on Design, I believe, if people want to go check it out. You mentioned at the end, and I'm quoting, if consumers understood design half as much as they understand technology, they'd be able to make better conscious and possibly world-changing decisions, unquote. So I guess I wanted to ask you, what do you mean by that? Because I've heard many designers talking about how people now are much more involved in, like, everyone has an opinion about design. Everyone, because we're such a visual society, we're constantly on the internet, constantly on Instagram. So people are more... they have more like design literacy, I guess. They have more opinion about design. And so you're talking about that as well, design literacy, and if people understood design more. So I guess my question is, do you agree that people have more knowledge about design now and more opinion about it? Do you think it's good the way things are going? What did you mean by your quote?
I think I understand that people have more opinions about design. But I'm not sure that they completely understand the impact of it. Like, for example, let's say I'm branding a company. I try not to deal with target audiences and things like that because it seems manipulative to me.
Yeah.
So I try to tell the story of the company and what they're selling and what they're doing more so than coming up with a font that a certain demographic may like more than another. And at this moment, I feel like more people are starting to pay attention to design in terms of aesthetics, but not like how it makes you feel psychologically and what it makes you do psychologically. Like how most restaurants have like yellow, orange, red colors because it makes you hungrier. Like I like to see people make more conscious decisions at that kind of psychological level, if that makes sense.
Oh, I know what you mean. That's very interesting because I don't think people realize how much like manipulation goes into the design decisions.
Right, exactly.
So finally, I don't know if you want to say anything about type design at the end, but also if you can maybe mention the links of Vocal Type, you know, maybe your Instagram account if people want to follow more about your work.
Thanks again for having me. If you want to learn more about Vocal Type, please visit www.vocaltype.co or follow me on Instagram at vocaltype.co.
With me on the phone from Washington, D.C., Trey Seals. Trey is a brand specialist. He's a type designer and graphic designer, and he's the founder of Vocal Type, which is an independent type foundry. So again, Trey, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I greatly appreciate it.
My name is Sausan Kadura, and you are listening to Digital Sites.
Until it's won.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it's won.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest. Until it's won.
Hello and welcome to Rank and File Radio Perry Edition. I'm your host, Emily Leadham. I sat down with Darren Stebaleski, graphic designer and one of the founding members of the Spark Poster Design Collective, about the role of graphic design in labor organizing.
How did Spark Poster get started?
Okay, so Spark Poster started as my own personal Twitter feed where I would just sort of comment on issues of design and leftist politics and where those issues intersected. At some point about 2 years ago, I decided that I wanted it to focus more, shift focus more onto doing rather than just talking about design. I went about the process of collectivizing the group and basically reaching out to members in my community that I knew had sort of the same social values and interests that I did as relate to design. And we eventually formed a collective, a closed collective of 9 members. I say closed because we're not actively taking on new members. I mean, we would be open to taking on new members if we know you and if we trust you, but we just don't want to, you know, be open, like accept anyone whose values we're not aware of or who we don't know. It's a very diverse collective. There's LGBTQ2 members, people of color, women of color in the group. And one of the first things that we wanted to do as a group was to do some sort of project that would be focused on raising class consciousness. We were very aware of our situations as graphic designers where we saw ourselves as, you know, new members of the working or members of the new working class. And typically creative jobs don't get seen that way. They're seen as sort of glamorous or exciting and that sort of thing. But the professor Leo Panitch pointed out in a Globe and Mail article in the last few years that these are actually the new working class jobs, that they're poorly compensated and they're not, you know, there's no benefits, there's no security. And in fact, you know, we may see ourselves as middle class, but in fact, we're of the new working class. And so we wanted to organize around that issue, but also to raise class consciousness in general and to get people to recognize, you know, there are problems in society and there is sort of a common antagonist in all those stories. And so one of the first projects that we sort of took on as a collective was to allow ourselves with a group like Fight for 15 And we saw ourselves being able to help a group like that get their message across.
So what are some of your favorite campaigns or movements that have utilized graphic design in an effective way?
Oh, there's so many. Do we have time for
quite a few? Go however long you want.
Okay.
And we can, yeah.
Okay. I love the work of, and our collective loves the work of the Just Seeds Collective. Or the Just Seeds Printmaking Cooperative, rather, in the United States. Specifically, like their Poor People's Campaign, their Liberating Learning Campaign, their Migration Now Campaign. They do amazing work. And it's just work that, you know, it speaks to our social values, but also it's work that you'd feel comfortable or you'd want to put on your wall. The Design Action Collective in the United States is a really great collective. They're best known for doing the Black Lives Matter identity. Visual identity that you see across the United States. And they've done some work around sanctuary cities. It's really cool. We like the work of the Center for Urban Pedagogy in the United States, which specifically their work around making policy public, or their campaign, where they take complicated policy issues of public policy, and then try to design them and frame them in a way that's more accessible to people, to average people, and the people that these policies affect. We really like the work of Extinction Rebellion, which is like a climate justice group in the United Kingdom. Their identity is really strong and powerful. There's a group called Barb that we really like in the States that's doing a lot of work, primarily around doing logos for like left-wing podcasts, it seems. But that work's really exciting to us. Democratic Socialists of America, their work is just so on point and so important right now. It's fun. It's always like, you know, you can recognize it as their branding, so it's consistent. The CUPW campaign, Delivering Community Power, we think is really a fun, exciting campaign. A lot of that's being worked on now by Kevin Lowe at Loki Design in Montreal. And their studio is just like, it's our ideal of a studio. It's their social work is so important, so good. They're making Races Afraid Again campaign is incredible. They've got campaigns against austerity, against racism or pro-migration. Like, they're just this incredible work, studio. So those are just some of our, some of who we're fans of.
Awesome. So when I think of labor campaigns, most labor campaigns, I feel like they're usually fairly generic looking, with a few exceptions. And this is not unique to union, but why do you think this sort of generic professional aesthetic is so appealing?
I suspect that it's probably about familiarity, safety. There's like a corporate look and feel that I think a lot of unions are going for, because they feel like, well, this is what people are used to seeing in their sort of daily, you know, their daily lives or daily working lives. So they're shooting for that sort of status quo. I think it's the opposite of what it should be. I think that if you're fighting for working people, you should be loud, you should be bold. This is a really noble cause. Like, I mean, fighting for working people, it's beautiful and it's right, it's correct, and it's proven time again, like throughout history, that, you know, we are on the right side when we fight this fight. And so the work should reflect that. And I think that, as I said, with like Just Seeds Collective or Cooperative, the work should feel, you know, you should want to put it up on your wall and at home. And I don't see like putting up a lot of that, you know, like the stock photo of like a worker or whatever that's smiling and with like a union logo beside it is really the best or most effective use of space. So I think like for it to be non-threatening in its look and feel, I mean, maybe organized labor should be threatening again a little bit.
Right, because labor does have a pretty rich history of imagery and graphic design. I have a few, thinking of the IWW particularly, I think everyone knows those sort of iconic images. So it's not like there's a lack of, you know, inspiration to draw from, for sure.
Yeah, the IWW work is something that we really draw a lot of inspiration from, for sure.
So when we started the Fight for 15 and Fairness campaign in Manitoba, we basically took the Ontario logo and aesthetic, because at the time we didn't have the resources to create our own branding. So a lot of our materials look somewhat professional in that way. I think that there can be real benefits to that in certain spaces and sort of communicating, you know, like you said, legitimacy and professional, like kind of signaling what people, when they look at this, they go, oh, this is some people have their they've got things together. But since you've got involved, a lot of our events have also revolved around getting people to create their own Fight for 15 imagery, like patches, buttons, and stickers, and postcards. Why do you feel like engaging people's creativity in this way is important in organizing?
Yeah, I think with a group like the Fight for 15, it's really important to keep that brand consistency across the board. Like you said, using the logo from the Ontario campaign is really effective because people are used to it and they've seen it. We've seen it, if you're paying attention at all to labor struggles across the country, we've seen it in other fights. And then seeing that coming here, I know, caught our attention as a collective because we were like, hey, we've seen that before. That's exciting. It's finally happening here, and that's great. So that's important for that recognition. But however, I do feel that some brand consistency, while it's great, you've got to balance it off with work that's crafted by people who are actually in the movement. There's a piece of text that as a collective, we're really excited about. And we sort of have used as a foundational document. It's an article called Bernie, Hillary, and the Authenticity Gap, a case study in campaign branding by a designer from the United States called Lindsay Ballant. Really good designer for Baffler magazine and really excellent writer. And she writes about how the contrast between the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Bernie Sanders campaign in the United States. And she mentions that, you know, where the Hillary campaign was really calculated and really expected and really contrived, it felt really tightly controlled as a result of that. And that felt more like a product launch or something that was being sold to people, where the Bernie campaign was like, you know, obviously a real people power movement because the work came from various sources, often just from fans. And it felt like, you know, messy and organic, and it's responsive and versatile, and it can sort of move on the fly, and it's not clean, and it isn't what we'd call, you know, quote unquote, good design, but that makes it feel real authentic. You know, centering people in the movement and their voices in the work is really going to be vital to the success of the campaign, because it's going to feel like it comes, you know, directly from the people who have the most most skin in the game, I guess, in this situation.
Everyone is talking about political memes. They're radicalizing the youth. They're shifting the Overton window, but they can also get criticized as just being slacktivism or not real organizing. What is your perspective on political memes and their relationship to social movements or lack thereof?
Okay. I personally love them. I'm a really big fan of memes. I feel like with memes, like, yeah, it's really easy. And especially in design circles, it's really easy to get sort of snobby about it and be like, well, they're not actually doing the work. They're not producing them. They're just sort of putting them online and whatever. But I think it's a really great way for people to engage with politics who might otherwise be very insular. And a lot of times designers are, you know, sort of much more like preferring to be behind the scenes or rather than out in front. And plus, like, memes, they really are modern form of, like, you know, propaganda or political postering or, you know, the modern political poster or cartoon. They're funny, and the left happens to be really good at them. So I don't think that we should cede that ground to the right. I mean, the right is historically really bad at making memes anyway. So I don't think we have to feel really like threatened in that regard. but by the same token, I don't think the left should stop making them because, yeah, we just can't let that ground go to them. I think, and the left particularly is good at them, I believe, because we often say in graphic design, you know, it used to be really important when you're a graphic designer to be able to draw. And now that's not important at all. What actually is important is to have a sense of empathy. And I think, like, if you're good at empathy, if you're good at feeling for people and what they want or need, then you'll be a good designer. And I think that's probably why leftists make, you know, really good meme creators. And so, like, you know, people will criticize the so-called dirtbag left, like, you know, the meme generators or whatever. But I think, like, more people are probably being radicalized by, you know, podcasts like Chapo Trap House, whatever you think of them, or by gritty memes and things like that than they are, you know, by reading the works of Karl Marx. So what I like about the memes is that they really infect the superstructure. And I think that's really what we need, is, like, to get as much of our culture into the culture as possible.
So graphic design is a pretty exploitative industry itself, like you mentioned before. What would you say to other graphic designers who are concerned about their working conditions?
I think for most graphic designers, it's important to recognize right off the bat that most of the owners of these firms are going to be, like, I guess what I would call, like, Obama liberals or, like, Trudeau liberals, the people that they'll say, you know, that old chestnut, like, oh, I'm I'm socially liberal, but I'm fiscally conservative. And I that statement just makes me bristle, because it's like, well, I'm against, you know, structural poverty and structural racism, but I'm not willing to do anything to challenge the actual structures. So when you accept that, and you accept that that's, you know, the owner's game, you can start to sort of, like, I guess, dissect what exactly you can do about that. The first thing I'd probably recommend is that any designer goes to look at the Registered Graphic Designers of Canada salary survey. They do the salary survey about, I think, every 2 years, the Creative Earner Salary Survey, they call it. And what you'll find in there will probably, like, shock you, as it did me. You'll probably find things that we know anecdotally to be true, like that, you know, wages are really low and have gone down, actually, in terms of real wages. For some context, like, the starting salary right now for a junior graphic designer coming out of school is probably about, like, $14 an hour. You know, we know that from our work with Fight for 15, that this is below a living wage. So to give that some context, I started graphic design in 1997, and I was making that same salary. So in that time, of course, with inflation, you know, that salary will buy you something like $14,000 less per year than it did then. So we're actually seeing, you know, wages roll back, and other things like, you know, the field is 65% female and 35% male. But you'll find from that survey that on average, women make $7,000 a year less than men. That's absolutely indefensible. So you put on top of that, like, unpaid overtime, a burnout culture, lack of benefits, lack of a pension, your labor is generating far more value for the company than you're being compensated for. If you think about the fact that you're probably being billed out at $100 an hour versus the 14 that you get, it doesn't take a math whiz to figure out that's a pretty unfair imbalance. So to me, like, the move has to be to unionization. I think that, like, for the days of designers doing all these, like, side hustles just to get by, the precarity of the jobs, you know, you're subject to the whims of the market. We need something to protect us, and we need something to fight for things like, you know, actual medical benefits, dental benefits, things that we wouldn't be able to afford on a salary like that. So I would say to designers, like, look to Game Workers Unite, which is a really exciting movement that's happening in the States and the UK.
They have a few chapters in Canada now too, which is great.
Oh, that's fantastic. I had no idea. I know they've had a lot of success in the UK getting certified. And I think that Game Workers Unite is a really good model, because they're fighting for the same things, or fighting against the same things that we are, like burnout culture, so-called crunch time, which is, you know, time that you've got to work unpaid overtime just to get a product out. And I think because they're a newer industry, and they're not maybe, like, this sort of burnout culture isn't so entrenched or inculcated into them, maybe that's why they're willing to fight where designers historically haven't. So I would look to them for inspiration. I would look to the AIGA in the United States, which is the Association of Graphic Designers. This is talking a lot more about unionization lately. And the designer Mike Montero is kind of spearheading this charge. He's got a book coming out soon, I think, and probably will discuss these issues as well.
Awesome. What resources would you recommend for any labor organizers or any other organizers interested in learning more about political graphic design?
I really like a book called Finally Got the News, which is the printed legacy of the U.S. radical left from 1970 to 79. Some really good examples of, like, how powerful union and worker-related design could be. The work of the CRED Women's Workshop out of England has really influenced us in a big way. Grappus, which is a French graphic design studio that was born out of the 1968 protests in France, have been a big inspiration. As well, there's a book called Developing Citizen Designers by Elizabeth Resnick that looks at case studies of different, like, you know, socially motivated methods and tactics in graphic design. You mentioned earlier the IWW. They've got an archive on Instagram. That's, I think, at IWW Archive. Really good resource. Just Eads is on Instagram. Loki Design is on Instagram at Lokimon. I also like the studios Propagate and Protest Stencil, which are out of the UK as well. And their thing is primarily, like, hijacking transit shelter ads and transit shelter advertising to put their own messages in there. It's very subversive and really, really cool work. And yeah, I'd recommend our own Instagram and Twitter as well, which is at SparkPoster in both cases.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for having this conversation. Do you have any final thoughts or comments that we didn't get to in the interview?
On the way over here, actually, I read an article by, I read a tweet from the group Inhabit, which is like a I guess they're sort of like an anarchist or leftcom collective that have put out this book called Instructions for Autonomy. That's like a really hopeful book about sort of coming crisis, if that sounds, if I could put it that way. And they tweeted an article about Paolo Antonelli in the magazine Design. And she's a well-known design curator. And in the article, she mentions this upcoming exhibition she's working on. And she says, the quote in the article says, "We don't have the power to stop our own extinction, but we have the power to make it count." And then goes on to say that, we should accept that and normalize that. And then we should at least design a beautiful ending. So to me, I was like, oh God, that's so bleak and so nihilistic. I can't even fathom that. Look around, everyone around us is reading, everyone around us is working, everyone's organizing. And I think there's so much hope to that, in that, like, in the face of like all these existential problems that we face, environmental collapse, poverty, racism, you know, the rise of fascism or whatever, we prefer to meet them head on. And in fact, if we are going to go down, then at least we're going to go down fighting.
That was Darren Stebuleski, graphic designer and member of the Spark Poster Design Collective. This is Emily signing off. I'll see you next week.
That's it for us for today. Thank you very much for joining me in this new episode of Digital Sites. Make sure to join me again next month for a new episode. Digital Sites airs every first Thursday of every month from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. For 1 hour, we cover topics and news related to digital visual arts. Also, a reminder that we have a Facebook page as well. Just look for Digital Sites. You will find us. My name is Sausan Kadura. I was your host for the hour. Thank you for listening. Trop vite, quand des adultes volent ton enfant, pas imagine un mur et un poli de la rage. Car impossible est cette paix d'en voulu. La rage de voir autant de CRS armés dans nos rues. La rage de voir ce putain de monde s'autodétruire et que ce soit toujours des innocents au centre des tirs. La rage, car c'est l'homme qui a créé chaque mur, ses barricades et béton. Aurait-il peur de la nature? La rage, car il a oublié qu'il en faisait partie des harmonies profondes. Mais dans quel monde la colombe est partie? La rage d'être autant balafré par les pécans des normes. Et puis la rage, ouais, la rage d'avoir la rage depuis qu'on est mort. Jusqu'au bout et là on veut bien nous mener la vie. On pourra plus taire ni s'asseoir. Dorénavant on tiendra prêt. Parce qu'on a la rage, le cœur et la foi. On restera debout quoi qu'il arrive. J'allais jusqu'au bout et là on veut bien nous mener la vie. Rien ne pourra plus nous arrêter. Insoumis, sage, marginal, humaniste ou révolté. La rage, parce qu'on choisit rien et qu'on subit tout le temps. Et vu que leurs choix sont bancales, et ben tout équilibre fout le camp. La rage, car l'irréparable s'entasse depuis un bout de temps. Car qu'est-ce qu'on attend pour se mettre debout et foutre le bouclier? La rage, c'est tout ce qui nous laisse. Façon, tout ce qui nous reste. N'iront pas retourner leurs fesses. La rage de vivre et de vivre l'instant présent. De choisir son futur libre et sans leur cri d'oppression. La rage, car c'est la merde et que ce monde y adhère. Et parce que tous leurs champs OGM stérilisent la terre. La rage pour qu'un jour l'engrenage soit brisé. La rage car trop lisse vérité sur leur écran télévisé. La rage car ce monde ne nous correspond pas. Nous nourrissent de forêts pour placer leur rempart. La rage car ce monde ne nous correspond pas. Où Babylone s'engraisse pendant qu'on crève en bas. Parce qu'on a la rage. Jusqu'au bout et là on veut bien nous mener la vie. On pourra plus taire ni s'asseoir.
manipulés comme leurs anges à la rage. Car on croit aux anges et qu'on a choisi de marcher avec la rage. Parce que mes propos dérangent, faut aux quatre coins du globe. La rage du feu, l'ébullition, la rage, ouais, la rage ou l'essence de la révolution. On restera debout quoi qu'il arrive, d'aller jusqu'au bout et là on veut bien nous mener la vie. On pourra plus se taire ni s'asseoir, dorénavant on tiendra prêt parce qu'on a la rage, le cœur et la foi. On restera debout quoi qu'il arrive, d'aller jusqu'au bout et là on veut bien nous mener la vie. Rien ne pourra plus nous arrêter, insoumis, sage, marginal, humaniste ou révolté. On restera debout quoi qu'il arrive, d'aller jusqu'au bout et là on veut bien nous mener la vie. On pourra plus se taire ni s'asseoir, dorénavant on tiendra prêt parce qu'on a la rage, le cœur et la foi. On restera debout quoi qu'il arrive, d'aller jusqu'au bout et là on veut bien nous mener la vie. Rien ne pourra plus nous arrêter, insoumis, sage, marginal, humaniste ou révolté.
What's up? This is Saul Williams chilling here in Montreal here on CKUT. Peace.
We pledge alliance with those who have undergone attack for voicing opposition to the war.
Suoni Peralpopolo is back and in real life for its 22nd edition. All the sights, sounds, and sensations of live music. After 2 years of online adaptation, Suoni is filling up the month of June with liberated music of all genres. Over 45 events and 90 participating artists performing indoors, outdoors, streamed for maximum accessibility. Record and book launches, workshops, a puppet show, a satellite Suoni happening in Wakefield, Quebec, of all places, and, of course, much more. For all the goodies, check out suoniperalpopolo.org. Masks will, of course, be required. For your audio program guide, tune in to the Montreal Sessions, Tuesday, May 24th, May 31st, and June 7 and 14th, from 3 till 5 p.m. The Suoni crew hosts will be serving up highlights of what to expect at this year's festival. This is, of course, a CKUT co-presentation.